things that are sufficiently different, or at least different in style, that I'm not going to cause everyone to fall asleep during the talk, but we'll test that hypothesis empirically. You also note that although this is a mini David session, the difference between that and the Everett interpretation is all Davids are different. Okay, so the probability problem in the Everett interpretation has generally been felt to be the major problem in making sense of the Everett interpretation. And for that reason, it's rather surprising and odd that various people in the last few years, me, David Papineau, Simon Saunders, David Deutsch, have been starting to hawk it as an advantage of the Everett interpretation, that it sorts out probability better. So I kind of just want to go through that claim rather slowly and carefully. So I'm going to start off by talking for about the first third of the talk about the status of probability in what I'm perhaps, for convenience, going to call classical physics, but I mean non-Everettian physics, which includes, say, dynamical collapse theories. And then I want to go on and talk about the way in which those probability arguments run in the Everett interpretation and the sense in which we actually are potentially better off there. I normally discuss this sort of material in a very heavily decision theoretics framework, and I'm actually going to try to do it this time with a relatively light amount of decision theory. My reason for that is to try to emphasize exactly how much or how little role specifically decision theoretic ideas have in this setup. That's slightly experimental, and we'll see how it goes. The probability problem in the Everett interpretation is also rather vast, and I can't possibly cover all of what I think is cogent about it. One of the major things I'm going to leave out is what you might call the evidential problem about Everett, which is basically, how should I think about probabilities if I'm not sure if Everett's true or not? How should I think about the extent to which the evidence I see in the world supports or doesn't support the truth of the Everett interpretation? I'm mainly not talking about that because both Philip Greaves and Wayne Merville are going to be talking quite extensively about it tomorrow, I think, or the day after. Yeah. Okay, that said, let's talk about probability in non-Everettian physics for a bit. Now, having studied physics, I've gone to the dark side, and I now live in a philosophy department. And one of the annoying habits of philosophers is to take something which you're fairly confident you understand and try to persuade you don't understand it properly after all. And I'm going to do that for a few minutes with probability. So, if you want to make sense of classical probability, again, I mean sort of non-Everettian probability, the premise here is that physics uses, it needs to use, a notion of objective probabilities. I just take that as something you can pretty much read off the content of physics. You know, it's not quite uncontroversial, but the idea of doing without something like the half-life of the neutron or something as an objective thing in the world that we talk about, theorize about, measure, and so on, seems kind of hard. So the fact that we have objective probability in physics, I'm more or less taking here as a starting point, or at least as a sort of prima facie true starting point. And there's basically three, vastly simplifying a complicated history, there are three ways of making sense of that that are potentially worth talking about here. And giving away the story in advance, those are frequentist approaches, which basically don't work, symmetry-based approaches, which basically don't work, and what I call functionalist-based approaches, which aren't really so much trying to work as they are saying why other things don't work. To justify that for a minute, the idea of probability as conceptually connected to frequency is probably the way in which most people learning about probability in physics first come across it. And it seems kind of reasonable. I mean, how actually do we use probabilities in physics? Well, we find that there seem to be pretty stable frequencies. If we do this experiment a million times, the first time we find 400,002 results of this sort. We do it a million times again, we find 399,972 results of this sort, and so on like that. And it's kind of very tempting to say, okay, well look, simplicity here, the probabilities just are the relative frequencies. And of course that's no use because, you know, I wait, the atom happens to decay, okay, so was its probability of decaying 1? No, of course it wasn't. So we say, okay, we're talking about the long run relative frequencies. And what do we mean by that? We mean something like, we'll let the run of the experiment get longer and longer and longer, and as we run the experiment for longer and longer and longer, then the relative frequencies will more and more and more closely approach the probability. And if that's true, we can basically just say the probability is by definition the number that the relative frequencies approach in the long term. And you see that a lot in sort of attempts to get undergraduates to get to grips with the idea of probability. It's problematic. It's problematic for two, well, for many reasons, but two reasons that are worth spelling out. One of those might be called the problem of single chances. A lot of the time where we use probability, we seem to be using them in ways that don't commit us to doing the experiment indefinitely many times. You know, maybe somehow I know something about what's going to happen if I run the experiment a million times. Actually, I'm planning to run it once because my budget doesn't allow me to run it more times than that. Or maybe I'm just interested in running it and then I'm going to go home and I'm wondering what to say about it now. And it's tempting to say that those things aren't very important, or somehow they're just a sort of way of speaking. But none of us really believe that. And it's quite easy to see, just to give a silly example as to why we don't think that. I mean, suppose that I construct a device that will destroy the universe, and I say, I plug this device into a Geiger counter. If the Geiger counter clicks, then my device will go off. And if it doesn't click in, let's say, the next 10 minutes, I'll dismantle the device and go quietly and attempt to be rehabilitated for my strange mental disorder or whatever. So in that circumstance, you're the responsible scientist brought in to decide which radioactive sample I'm going to point the Geiger counter to. Do you choose the sample with the long half-life or the short half-life? I hope you choose the sample with the long half-life. Why? Because it's way less probable that it will go off. Is that about relative frequencies? Well, it's hard to see how. I mean, we might be able to say things about the relative frequency of samples of that kind, but that's not relevant. What matters is the particular sample on the desk here and now. It, by definition, can't be the relative frequency of number of times the universe ends. So we use these single case chances all over the place. I mean, and that example is fanciful, but if you just think about a lot of the more standard examples, you just see that we make use of this concept pretty extensively. Different, rather more technical, possibly rather more serious concern. Here's what we'd like to have be true for the idea of probability equals long-run relative frequency to work. We'd like it to be the case that in the long run, as the number of runs of the experiment goes to infinity, the relative frequency tends to the probability. And we can prove something that's almost that. What we can actually prove is, in the long run, the relative frequency tends to the probability probably. And that's kind of worrying if you're trying to define something. You know, what is it for somebody to be in love? It is for them to be in neural state 50129 and to love someone. That's kind of not much good as an analysis of the notion of love in my physical terms. If we could say long-run relative frequency equals probability, we'd be fine. If all we can say is long-run relative frequency equals probability with high probability, even if all we can say is, as the number of runs of the experiment gets higher and higher and higher, the probability that the relative frequency doesn't equal the probability gets lower and lower and lower, still we're kind of not getting out of this circle. So that seems to be a reason to be rather worried about the frequentist approach. Let's try something else. In physics, in practice, we tend to run into probabilities via relative frequency. But as Wojciech pointed out, that's not the only place in which we come across probability. It's not even the first place in which we came across quantitative probability. We also come across probability as a guide to action, as a guide to the kind of bets we're willing to make. Some of those statements don't really seem to be physics at all. They just seem to be psychology. I reckon it's more likely than not, probably much more likely than not, the Democrats will take back the White House in 08. That strikes me as rather likely. Maybe Hillary disagrees. Maybe Hillary thinks it's unlikely. It's not at all clear here that one of us is objectively wrong about some numerical fact. I mean, we might be able to argue about it, but somehow it seems that's more making a statement about our sort of psychological state than anything else. So at least that kind of looks plausible. We're saying, when I say the probability of the Democrats winning the White House is 0.8 or something, then it doesn't at all obviously seem that I'm pointing to some physical fact in the world. There's a 0.8 sitting there in the White House somehow that's causally connected to the political chance of the Democrats. And it kind of seems that Hillary and I can both think that, and one of us might be more or less justified, but there's no reason to say one of us is objectively right and one of us is objectively wrong. All right, but then there's a different situation. This die is fair. It's a six-sided die. I claim this die is fair. What I mean by that, I mean the probability of it landing 6 is 1/6, and the probability of it landing 4 is 1/6, and so on. That seems to be something I can be objectively right or wrong about and collect evidence about and get facts about. We're at least rather more inclined there to say it's an objective fact, that the probability of a six is 1/6. The probability of getting the king of spades in your, when you pick a card is 1 in 52. Things like that seem kind of safer. Why? Well, here's one stab at it, which is hopeless. Because there are six possibilities, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I've got no particular reason to prefer any of them because, you know, why would I want to? So we'll go for probability of 1/6. And that's clearly a terrible argument. How many ways are that the die could land? How many ways could the die land? Well, it could land on a 1, or it could land on a face that's not 1. So that's two possibilities. Maybe it'll be a 1, maybe it'll be a face that's not 1. Well, that's what it is. I mean, what's really going on, if you think about it, is there are continually many ways the die could land. How I cut up that space of continuum infinity possibilities into the ones I want to analyze and then say they're all equally probable is highly arbitrary unless I bring in some other principle. Okay, you say, but look, there's a blatantly obvious other principle to bring in: symmetry. The die is symmetric. The only difference between the side of the 6 on it and the side of the 1 on it is the arbitrary fact I put 6 dots on one side and 1 dot on the other side. And you can kind of make that a bit more rigorous, at least a bit more careful. You can say, well, look, if I throw the die and it lands, you know, if I'm going to say, look, I'll throw the die and once it lands 6, I'll just take the 6 off and put a 1 on. Or maybe even before I throw it, I'll very carefully take the 6 off and put a 1 on. You might want to say, look, that swapping of the labels, that mere relabeling of the die, can't make any difference. But then you run into the situation that the situation where I swap the labels is physically identical to a situation where the die was in a different configuration when rolled. So if the probability of the die landing with the 6 side up is unchanged, if I swap the 6 and a 1, in other words, it's still the same probability as it was before, and if the configuration where I swap the 6 and the 1 is just physically the identical situation than the situation where it was a 1 in the first place, if those claims are both right, then I've got no choice but to set the two probabilities equal. Now, that's how the symmetry type argument can go. Two problems with that. Again, there may be more. Here's a problem which I don't think is all that great, but is worth taking seriously because it has interesting analogies in the quantum case. How do I know swapping the labels isn't relevant? Maybe ones are lucky. Maybe it's a property of probability, whatever that thing was, that sides with ones on come up more often. After all, we know in some situations it is relevant. If I label the die with little metal dots and there's a strong magnetic field on the table, it's highly relevant whether there's a 6 or the 1. And you kind of want to say that there's a dynamical reason there. I've got a dynamical reason in that situation to say why the labels matter. Generically, I don't have that. But that sort of argument is at least a bit shaky in this situation because, you know, we're still not quite sure what we're talking about here. We're still talking about this kind of probability thing, what odds I should give, something like that. What exactly is going on that makes me say, okay, I'm justified in just saying ones aren't lucky? So there's a sort of niggling worry there. Is it that serious? I'm not so sure. Here's something that really is serious. It can't possibly be the case that just because the die is symmetric, the probability of it landing with each face up is the same. If I take, let's make this vivid, say I take a wooden die and it's 3 foot across, completely symmetric, it's 3 foot across, I lift it up an inch above the table with the 6 side on the top, and I let go of it. Is the probability that it lands with the 6 side up 1 in 6? Kind of inclined to think not. Those who disagree, I'd be interested in playing some sort of game for high stakes later in the day. What's going on there? Well, answer, notwithstanding the symmetry of the situation, it deterministically follows from the fact I put the die there that it was going to land with the 6 up. But hang on, from any possible configuration of the die, it deterministically follows it's going to land on some side. It's a classical system, X hypothesis. And, I mean, incidentally, if I put some genuine randomness in, it wouldn't help because the genuine randomness is going to have these numbers attached to it, which are the things we're trying to make sense of in the first place. I mean, here's a way of making it a bit more dramatically vivid. If the dynamics have this particular symmetry, the initial state can't possibly have this particular symmetry because it's got to land one side or another. The initial state has got this particular symmetry to it, and the dynamics have got this particular symmetry to it, then the final state's got this particular symmetry to it as well. So either there's something in the dynamics that's breaking the symmetry, or there's something in the initial state that's breaking symmetry. And in classical physics, of course, we're going to take the dynamics of the deterministic. So there it's going to be something in the initial state that's breaking the symmetry. So then it's kind of interesting to ask, how do these randomness arguments work in that case? And I think the right thing to say about it is, look, what we really deduce from the symmetry of the die is that those regions of phase space corresponding to the die landing with one up have the same volume as those regions of phase space corresponding to situations where we get the die landing on six. And that does follow from the symmetry arguments. So if that's the case, then the phase space looks like, I don't know, make it stripy. Here's the region with a 1, and here's the region with a 2, and here's the region with a 3, and so on. And these are all of equal volume. And if I... The point about dice is they're unpredictable, they're quite chaotic, or get it, or not necessarily literally chaotic, but certainly extremely hard to predict in practice. If I throw the dice from a nice height and so forth, these regions are very small compared to the macro state of the initial conditions, compared to that region of possible micro conditions I take seriously for the die. Let that region be this or something. Or maybe it's much, much bigger than that. And so the highly complicated, weird structured one region and two region, three region are so small and so mixed up among themselves on the scales of this big blob of possible conditions that I can be pretty confident for that particular blob that the volume of it corresponding to one, the volume of it corresponding to six are the same. Okay, big wow. How does that help? It doesn't at all directly, unless I know that the probability of the die being in a given region of phase space is proportional to that phase space volume. I'll take clarification questions. I probably won't take substantive ones. So now we've got a problem again. So what does symmetry let us do? Symmetry lets us say, okay, well, the probabilities are determined by the symmetries of the state, provided that the initial system is in a given region of phase space with a probability proportional to the region of that phase space. Oh dear. We again don't seem to have managed that nice elimination of probability that we were kind of hoping for. And as I say, we can kind of see that we couldn't have because something's got to be breaking the symmetry. It's got to be broken. Maybe it's being broken by the asymmetry of the die, but in that case, this thing fails. Maybe it's broken by the initial state, but in that case, we have to put some probability distribution on the initial state. Maybe it's broken by some random dynamics that says, you know, the system, if it's here, might go here, or might go here, or might go here, or might go here. But to state that random dynamics, we're going to have to introduce the notion of probability into the game again. And unless we can analyze that notion in terms of symmetry or frequency, we're just in an infinite regress. Well, if we do analyze in terms of symmetry or frequency, we're back in the same infinite regress. So, okay. We seem to be running into trouble here. So let's take a step back. General principle in philosophy, if you're trying to work out what something is or what its essence or nature is, it's kind of helpful to look at what it does, how we use it, how it links to our other ideas and concepts. The jargon term for that is to analyze something in functional terms. So we want to ask, how do we use the probability concept? Well, we use it in two ways, as we've seen. One is essentially as a guide to what we should do. We bet according to our probabilities. And the other is that we learn about the probabilities by looking at the frequencies in the world. So those seem to be the two ways in which probability plugs into the rest of how we do stuff. And in fact, it's fairly well known that if we've got the idea that the probability works as a guide to action, and we have other assumptions of a not particularly probabilistic character, we can get the link between frequency and probability. Essentially because you're just recasting things as saying, what we meant to say the long run relative frequencies will equal the probabilities probably is to say, if you conduct an experiment many, many times, it's extraordinarily irrational not to bet on the long run relative frequencies being about the same as the probabilities. So that's fine. What it is for this particular magnitude in our theory to be probability is it's got to be the thing we use for guide to action. And as I say, this is a kind of game we do a lot. I mean, what is it to be electric charge? What's the inner essence of electric charge? Well, what a silly question. Electric charge interacts with other things. We'll say electric charge in certain ways. It responds in certain ways to certain fields. It generates certain fields. Asking what electrical charge is beyond those sort of structural dynamical questions doesn't really seem a terribly interesting question to ask. It certainly doesn't seem to be a question within the space of what physics does. All right, so are we home and dry? Kind of no. What is this abstract, this magnitude null theory that we're talking about? Well, if we really step back and just look at what it is mathematically, it's a measure on the space of histories of the system. What is that thing? Well, goodness knows. Does that matter? Do we need to know what it is beyond this functional thing? I mean, I just said that's the game we're playing. Well, there's two kind of ways we might do this sort of functional definition move. We might say, okay, it's a non-basic thing. We're going to say what it is, something in our theory which we already understand in independent terms to be fitting this particular functional characteristic. What is it for something to be a $5 bill? It's to play a certain role in a certain structure, viz. That of people who use and spend US currency. But that's not primitive. We understand why those rules are true in a deeper level, and we understand independently what that $5 bill is. You know, it's got a micromolecular description. The fact that it's a $5 bill follows from it fitting into this particular structure, but that's not some basic, fundamental, underived truth of the world. And it had better not be, because the sort of concepts coming into it don't look like the sort of concepts we'd like to have in our basic underived theory of the world. We don't really want these sort of principles of human interaction and human psychology to be playing an important part in the basic underivable physics. And by contrast, in the case of electric charge, we don't particularly mind. We're not bothered by the fact that it might be a basic principle that electric charge does what it is. We don't feel that if somebody says, you know, the electric charge responds to the electromagnetic field according to such and such dynamical principles, we don't desperately feel there must be a deeper reason why. If we can find a deeper reason, great, but we don't really mind the fact that our fundamental physics will just ground out somewhere. But we're kind of uncomfortable if it's grounding out somewhere that makes essential commitment to things like action and rationality and decisions and so on. And so that's why in the money case, we don't think the laws of economics should be a basic set of laws of nature. In the probability case, it should at least make us worried as well. Saying this basic fundamental thing is probability, and therefore that this thing fundamentally plays a certain role in decision making, and that's all there is to say, is worrying. Maybe we can live with it, maybe not. Summary of the story so far. We can't seem to work out how anything in the world could play the role of probability. We tried frequency, no good. We tried symmetry, no good. The counsel of despair of modern philosophy, mostly, is that the best we can do is just say it's true by definition, it's probability. It's not at all clear we should be happy with that. It's not at all clear what else we could do. End of part one. What about the Everett interpretation? Well, it's more similar than it. In the non-Everettian case, the probability is a measure on the space of histories of the system. What the Everettian is going to claim is that probability is also the same. Probability for the Everettian definitionally is going to be mod squared amplitude of the set of branches we're interested in. We know from the decoherent history formulas how to do this fairly carefully. Given a decoherent history space, the state defines a measure on that space. The decoherence condition makes sure it functions the way it's supposed to do. Okay. What are the differences? Well, non-Everettian case. The space of histories isn't real, only one history in it is real. The Everettian case, of course, that's not true. They're all real. They're all, albeit they're sort of overlapping structural things within an overall quantum state with the particular structure interested in picked out by decoherence in a way which isn't really the topic of this talk. In the non-Everettian case, we have no clue what that measure is. We just put it in by hand. We can specify all the physical facts about the physical universe in the non-Everettian case, and that wouldn't fix the probability. In the Everettian case, we do have a good understanding of it dynamically. We know dynamically how amplitude functions in quantum mechanics. It's conceptually impossible to state quantum mechanics without the amplitudes. By definition, the thing I'm calling probability is just this mod squared amplitude of branches. So we've got an independent understanding of what this quantity is in the usual dynamical way we understand things like the electric charge. What else? Here's a similarity. For the non-Everettian, it's supposed to be some kind of guide to action. What about for the Everettian? Well, Simon's talked about this a bit. In the Everett interpretation, how are we going to manage to think about the probability? It's going to have to be playing the role of saying something like, okay, I'm about to do some sort of quantum experiment that's going to cause some sort of branching. Maybe I've already done some such experiment, I don't know the answer. How am I going to think about that situation? how, for instance, if I was asked to bet on the result of a quantum experiment, how am I going to bet? Those sort of questions. Another threatening case, we know how this thing is supposed to function as a guide to action. We know what it's supposed to be doing. We don't know why it does that. We don't know why it, in fact, does what it's supposed to do. In the threatening case, maybe we do, maybe we don't. Let's leave that for now. Okay, now that's not, the way I put that, it looks awfully similar, but that's not generally how people see it. It's generally felt that somehow the situation, is, despite those formal similarities, is way worse in the Everett case. Here are the kind of reasons people come up with. Why might probability be worse in the Everett case? Well, here are some differences. There's no unique outcome in the Everett case. All the possible results of the experiment turn up in the wave function. They just turn real. That's certainly not true in the classical case. And since in the classical case, the fact only one outcome occurs is playing a vital role in our understanding how probability works and what probability is, we're in trouble. Oh, wait a minute. In the classical case, the fact there was only a single outcome wasn't playing any role at all in our understanding of what's going on because we don't have an understanding of what's going on. We know how the thing works. We know how to use it, but we haven't got a story as to why. We can use it just fine in the Everett case in the same way. It makes sense, whether it's crazy to do so isn't the point. It makes sense to say, okay, I'll bet on the result of the experiment according to the quantum weights. The fact that any one outcome occurs isn't stopping, whether all the outcomes occur, isn't stopping me doing that. Well, let's try to sharpen that up. Maybe the problem is every possibility happens somewhere. How can I possibly be concerned about certain frequency, you know, that certain results of the experiment, given all the results happen? How can I possibly take such and such a run of data to confirm my theory if all those runs of data are out there? Well, all those runs of data being out there is kind of unintuitive, but that's not an argument for why it's not problematic. The rules for using the Everett probability concept to say what's going on are still there. The rules tell me perfectly clearly what data I should expect to see. The fact that all data's out there is not stopping that being true. And furthermore, there are examples of that sort of phenomenology classically as well. Here's a mundane one. Suppose we have a lottery and all 14 million tickets are sold. And let's say the lottery result was determined in advance and secretly it's in a vault somewhere. So we're all given a lottery ticket. I am perfectly rational in assuming I won't win that lottery. Everyone is in my position. We're all perfectly rational in assuming we won't win that lottery. It's very sensible for all of us to not plan on winning the lottery. Indeed, to, for instance, you know, make plans which assume I won't win the lottery. Even though we all know that one of us is wrong in that stage. It so happens David's going to win the lottery. So David is making a profoundly wrong decision when he plans on not winning the lottery. That doesn't make David or any of the rest of us irrational in deciding that. A slightly more surreal example, but not dramatically. Current consensus in cosmology, it might change next week, but at the moment, is that the universe is open, it's spatially infinite, it's broadly homogeneous. If that's true, then worlds arbitrarily similar to this, I don't mean Everett worlds, I mean solar systems, arbitrarily similar to this, are to be found out there. Maybe they're 10 to the 100 light years away. Maybe they're 10 to the 10 to the 100 light years away. It doesn't matter. 10 to the 10 to the 100 is still quite small compared to infinity. So if that's the case, out there are arbitrarily many repeats right now, right here and now, of any experiment I'm running. And that being the case, we know for sure that if we're about to make a certain measurement that's trying to determine a half-life, every possible combination of decay events is going to be realized in the universe, and furthermore, realized infinitely many times. Infinity divided infinity is kind of hard to make sense of. In that situation, it seems we should be just as horrified and just as extraordinarily shocked, and yet we don't seem to be. Why not? Because we didn't understand this probability thing in the first place, but its rules are still perfectly clear. Expect to find odds that can, the relative fixity about the probability, notwithstanding the fact that infinitely many counterparts of me deep out and in super intergalactic space get the answer wrong that way. Nonetheless, we get on with things. It's unproblematic. What else? Well, mod squared amplitude, what else might be the difference? Mod squared amplitude already has a defined meaning in the theory. So what? Again, we didn't have anything in our argument that said we'll understand better what's going on with probability if it's primitive. There's no particular difference between taking amplitude a new physical quantity and postulating it satisfies some totally unexplained rule, and taking an existing physical quantity and postulating it satisfies some totally unstated rule. What else? The obvious rational choice is to value all branches equally. Why should I value my counterparts in the high weight branches more than the low weight branches? That would be fine if there was a finite number of branches or even a determinate manageable space of branches. Any look at the decoherence theory in detail that goes beyond impressionistic shows that's not plausible. The decoherence turns up at certain coarse graining states of affairs. The precise level at which we coarse grain that is largely up for grabs. You know, there are, one can close in or close out, and if one looks too close, one starts finding that the coherence between branches is kind of just beginning to become detectable or problematic, so one thinks that's too close, so we go out a little bit. There's not going to be anything stable or discernible here. And I mean, another way of seeing that is that the sort of branching processes going on in decoherence are generic continuum processes. The pointer basis, as what you were talking about, is generically something like a coherent state basis. We can chop that coherent state basis up into chunks that are orthogonal to each other, but the way we do, and if we chop it too fine, we'll break decoherence, and if we chop it not fine enough, we'll start lumping together states that we really don't want to lump together, like really obviously macroscopically detectably different states of affairs, but within that, we've got an awful lot of choice. There's branching structure, but the branching structure doesn't lead to anything remotely like a determinate count of worlds. Maybe you independently think that's a reason to reject effort, incidentally. I think you'd be wrong to think that, but that's not the topic of this talk. If decoherence succeeds in solving the preferred basis problem for the Everettian, it does so in a way that does not provide a determinate branch count. So that's not an option either. All right, so that being the case, what's left of the disanalogy between probability in Everett and probability none in Everett? We'll claim not very much. Even if we don't understand probability in the Everett interpretation, we didn't understand it classically either, and we didn't have a good set of reasons for seeing there's any difference between them, and those superficially persuasive reasons claim don't work out. Quick comment here, we can see that again if you look at the early history of the probability approach in the Everett interpretation, when people tried to deduce probability from frequency in Everett, and they proved theorems that basically say, as the number of repetitions of the experiment gets larger and larger, the quantum state tends to an eigenstate of the relative frequency operator. Tends to meaning what? It means it gets closer and closer. What does that mean? It means the weight of the none correct branches gets smaller and smaller. What would the Everettian like to have proved? He'd like to have proven that in the long run, the relative frequency tends to the weights. What did he actually prove? He proved the relative frequency tended to the weights with high weights. Is that circular? Yes. Is it the same circularity as in the classical case? Yes. Corollary of that, incidentally, if you didn't buy my objection to the classical frequentism, you should be happy with the frequentist approach to everything. What gets interesting, part three of the talk, if you like, is where we start looking at the symmetry type of properties. Because recall, in the classical case, the laws might have a certain frequency, but the state couldn't have, the laws might have a certain symmetry, but the state couldn't also have that symmetry, because how else could we have a particular outcome? How else could we have one rather than six if both the initial state of the die and the laws of the die are symmetric about the 1-6 swap? In the Everettian case, there's no problem with that. We don't get a one rather than a six. The symmetry of the state can perfectly happily ramify up to a symmetry of the final state, because we think that symmetry of the final state is there. So there's a prospect, at least, in the Everett interpretation that those sort of symmetry-based arguments, which turn out not to work out classically, might work out. Premise of most of the rest of the talk is going to be, yes, they do. Here's what I claim follows from the considerations I want to bring up. What follows from them is the claim Wojciech was making, which is that when we have a superposition of equally weighted branches, they're equally probable. How does that argument go? How do I get to the board? Does that help me get another one down? I'm too short. Thank you. All right, so here's the basic name of the game. So let's just consider a situation where we've got an equally weighted superposition of two states and we measure it. So we know the initial state of the system is something like that. And we measure it, and then the system starts in some state like that, like this. And it evolves, let's say it evolves under some interaction U to a state of the form where that's a state that's just got plus displayed on the screen. And U is the measurement process that we're giving, isn't it? And what we need to be the case to make a probability argument work for the Everettian is that I should regard this state and this state as equally probable, in the sense that, for definiteness, I would bet equally on the result being up as I would as I bet on the result being down, equally on plus or on minus. And here's the intuition. The only difference between that state and that state is this inessential labeling thing. This state happens to have the plus on the screen, this on the minus screen. That's just the labeling of those two outcomes. So the intuition or the hope is going to be that,
The plus, for example, is supposed to be a composite state, a state of the composite system.
Yeah, I've rolled these in. It might not be a repeatable variable.
Right.
So by all means, it might, for instance, be plus tensor. Certain outcome. Right. You might think this is dead.
Yeah, sure. I just want to make sure.
So the intuition is going to be that because these are simply labels, the only difference between this situation and the situation where, say, I've gone the other way round is going to be that the labels have changed. And to make that a bit more vivid, let's not make an equally weighted superposition for a minute. Suppose I had instead alpha plus plus beta minus, and suppose I measured it in the same way and I got the result alpha, it's a plus, plus beta, it's a minus. And so this is the U transformation. And suppose instead I'd done, alternately I might have done a different transformation where I used different output states. I displayed a plus when the result was really minus, and I displayed a minus when the result was really plus. Then I get something like so the intuition from the symmetry argument is going to be, since the only difference between that and that is the fact I've changed the label on them, rational agents should be giving I should be giving the same probability to it. We can make sense of that if we like decision theoretically. Rational agents would bet on it with the same odds. But if you've got an alternative way of thinking about probability, run with it. And then in a particular case, therefore, where the amplitudes are equal, then this state, if alpha equals beta, then this state is that state. And there's an issue with phase. Okay, but then you remember I said that one of the problems of the symmetry argument was the fact of the symmetry of the state, and that's not a problem here, but the other problem is why are we confident labels don't matter? That's what we need to establish in this context. Well, maybe it being a plus is somehow importantly different than being a minus. And for example, that sounds a bit silly, but label could mean something rather broad here. I could be measuring the system with wildly different devices. I could be making all sorts of different auxiliary measurements in the process. I make measurements some while, and then I come back and I do something different. There's probably vast amounts of branching hidden away inside this nice simple ket, and loads of branching hidden away inside this one. So it's not actually necessarily so innocent to say we don't care about labels. If you think it is innocent by the way we're done. So one interesting thing about Everett is that it gives us a situation where symmetry actually does, where the symmetry of the state is compatible with the outcomes we have because all the outcomes are realized. Another advantage of it, though, is that because this thing is supposed to be an actual physical state of the world, needed a complete physical description of the state of the world, we've got all the information present. We actually got to get a rather sharper grip on exactly what is and is not relevant to these questions about what transformations of labour are important. And a way of making that particularly clear is to think about it in kind of decision theoretic terms. So here's what we're going to be after. If an agent is betting on a quantum measurement, if that's how we're making sense of the probabilities in this case, then there's a reason the labels aren't relevant. The reason the labels aren't relevant is he doesn't care what they are. All he cares about is the reward he gets. And that means he won't mind if we change them, for instance, after doing the measurement. Let me cache that out. We'll go somewhere. So, let's say our agent is taking a bet on the result being spin up, which means that he's going to get some state which we might call, say the agent is going to go to some state which we might call dollar. So the initial, the system state is going to evolve into something like, after the measurement, after the reward is given, something like 1 over root 2 plus dollar plus 1 over root 2 minus no dollar. The agent really doesn't care anymore about what that is or that is. The agent, or the two agents, an agent here in this situation, an agent in this situation. This agent's got his money. He doesn't care about the system anymore. So we get rid of the label and he doesn't mind. This agent doesn't care anymore. We get rid of the label and he doesn't mind. How do we get rid of it? We could just drop into a volcano. What are we really careful about? We could send it off far away. Light years away, so we can't interact with it. So this is now starting to intersect the sort of things that Wojciech was talking about. We go to something like some sort of rubbish which we don't care about, dollar, plus no dollar. So our agent, whatever the agent thinks about the universe ending up in this state, he's just as happy for it to end up in this state. But now the point is, he could have got to this state by going the other way around. He could have got to this state by getting the reward on the result of minus and then having the result erased. So two physically different routes, different situations. One a situation where the agent bets on a dollar, and one where the agent bets on the result being spin up, and one where the agent bets on the result being spin down, leads to precisely the same physical state of affairs. That's the outline of the argument here. If that's the case, claim, a rational agent, given a situation where the universe is going to be paired in precisely the same state of affairs by one of two different ways, which let us suppose doesn't include the agent being tortured during the process of being paired that way or something like that, doesn't mind how you do it. Handsome is as handsome does. The agent's going to be interested in the state that the universe is in after the end of the game. The state that the universe is in after the game where he gets a dollar on spin up and then the result is thrown away is the same as the result in the agent in the situation where he gets spin down and the result is thrown away. Therefore, the agent must value them equally. If he values them equally, the only way to do that in probabilistic terms is to put an equal probability on the up result and the down result. From there, one basically spins the same spin that Wojciech was running. One handles phase in kind of similar ways. The agent is not bothered about the fact you might make a phase transformation in some place. By all means, do it. But, I mean, this is almost exactly the same as Wojciech's position now. By all means, do it light years away. Okay, what I tend to find giving this sort of argument before is that it's kind of not convincing to the unconvinced, and a lot of the reason for that is because not so much the people have a specific problem with this, but they can immediately think of alternative ways we could do things that don't seem compatible, that aren't this and that don't seem problematic. So I think rather than spend much longer on this, I'm just going to talk a bit about other strategies you might try and why they don't work. But here are some other things we might try. We might want to say, well, why don't I just give each branch, my new strategy is I give each branch equal weight, even if they've got unequal amplitudes. there are conceptual problems with that, but the simplest objection to it is just to say it relies on the fact there's such a thing as definite branch weight. Why don't you might say, well, look, all of this effectively is assuming that the measurements are non-contextual, in which case it's just Gleason's theorem. I'll have a contextual probability measure, and that's officially plausible, but it doesn't exactly make sense because contextuality or non-contextuality is something we need to talk about in the context of the particular mathematical description of the experiment. This experiment is a measurement of spin half on this system. But measurement devices don't come stamped with certain unit transformations or certain orthogonal bases, and if they did, the stamp wouldn't mean anything. The actual physical measurement device in the lab can be interpreted as a device doing vast numbers of different measurements, according to how we decide to think about it. I mean, the Stern-Gerlach experiment can be regarded as a measurement of particle position, or it can be regarded as a measurement of particle spin. If you insert a spin flip earlier in the experiment, you can regard that as part of the measurement or part of the state preparation. In philosopher's jargon, the mathematical descriptions of quantum experiments cross-classify the real physical systems. So to even think in non-contextual terms doesn't really get you off the ground. You've got to be thinking in terms of what particular physical, I'm going to have different strategies towards different physical systems that maybe have the same measurement description. Well, what could we do in that way? Well, what about using some other property of the branches other than or in addition to branch weight? There's a nice example of David Albert's, which I'll borrow, which is to say, I'm not just bothered about my weight as in multiple amplitude, I'm bothered about my weight in pounds and ounces. I'm actually going to assign a probability to each branch proportional to the quantum weight of that branch times my fatness on that branch. And of course, that's going to define a measure of an instant at least. But I'm not doing that because I actually like being fat. I'm just doing it because that's a different rationality strategy, which is coherent. And the problem with that sort of strategy is that if I really don't care about fatness, then after the event, I'm going to be relaxed about erasing it. I'll be indifferent to whether or not I diet after the result of the experiment. And once one starts doing that sort of situation, one runs into a lot of paradoxes, which are basically about the fact that we don't mind how the state's prepared, provided that it's prepared. So, for instance, to continue playing David's example, I want to go on holiday. I've got a chance of winning the lottery. I want to go on holiday. To increase my chance of winning the lottery, or increase the utility to me of deciding to buy a lottery ticket, I resolve that I'll fast if I lose the lottery, and I'll gorge myself on holiday if I win the lottery, which increases the fatness of me on the lottery winning branches, and therefore increases the utility of it. Problem with that, of course, is that in fact, I predict in advance that since I don't care about my weight, and since, in fact, on holiday I generally don't like to bother with food very much, I predict that I won't, in fact, gorge while on holiday. And I predict that I won't, in fact, fast when I don't win the lottery because I know I love comfort eating. So it's rational for me now to hire bodyguards to force feed me on the branch where I win the lottery and starve me on the branch where I don't win the lottery. And I better do it in such a way that it's not going to be detected by my future selves. And you can kind of run these things indefinitely, and what you basically come up with is somebody who's got that level of inconsistency between what they want to do at different times is just not somebody you'd want to dignify with the name agent. And where that fits into this kind of story is the fact that the different ways of preparing the state, lottery and being fat, me losing the lottery and not being fat, have got to be equivalent in some important way. It doesn't matter how I prepare it. For instance, I might prepare it by fasting after I win or before I win or whatever. I can't do it. I've got to do those things equivalently because they lead to the same state of affairs. And if I start doing that, I'm going to run into these massive sort of intertemporal conflicts, which is going to render me incapable of actually acting. Finally, I might decide I'll use a different quantum state. I won't use the real quantum state. And the problem with that is going to be, well, any state other than the real quantum state, there's going to be some measurement according to the real quantum state, it definitely gives a certain outcome. According to the fake quantum state, it only sometimes gives a certain outcome. If, in fact, I know deterministically that a certain measurement will definitely give an outcome, I clearly should bet on it at arbitrary odds. So there's going to be a certain strategy recommended to me by using the false quantum state, which is just going to go against what I know deterministically will happen from the real quantum state. Those are all sketches. All that's just as a sort of starting point for what I was thinking in those kind of directions. I've got about 2 minutes left. Yeah. Okay, so just to wrap up, here's what the ever here's some things that are wrong with the ever interpreting. Here's some things it can't do. Can't explain why space-time is four-dimensional. Can't explain the mass of the proton. Can't tell us why math is effective in physics. Can't tell us how consciousness can emerge from physical matter. Can't solve the Arab-Israeli conflict. These are not actually problems with the ever interpretation. Why? Well, because no other interpretation of quantum mechanics can do that either. And because our physical theories are not basically in the business of doing those sort of things. We don't really expect them to do that sort of thing. We haven't really, we don't really expect our physical theories to solve the problem of probability. If the ever interpretation doesn't solve the problem of probability, then that's not a criticism of it. But that'd be the case. It's rather startling and nice that maybe it does anyway. That's a bonus of the ever interpretation. From a philosopher's point of view, it's a very interesting bonus. From a physicist's point of view, it's fairly minor compared to making sense of all of our current physics about changed equations, but it'll do in the next. I'll stop there.
So I'd like to re-ask a question that Jim Bartle posed this morning. So we've had a very nice derivation of wonderful from you, and from Wojtek Zurek, and from Hugh Everett, and from various other people. And it would be very helpful if you could give your quick summary as to how you see these different derivations as being related.
Sure. I mean, what I think about the relation between the sort of Deutsch's approach I followed up and the sort of approach that Wojciech pushed, I think it's basically something like this. The common factor is that one is taking an equally weighted superposition and essentially trying to do something in the form of an argument which strengthens just the intuition, if you like, that somehow the labels on the states are irrelevant. Here's how I take Wojciech's method of doing that. Entangle that system, it's going to happen anyway. I rely on the fact that system is already entangled with other distant stuff. Note the fact that the physical transformation I can do on the system, this is taking Wojciech stuff in Everett language, if you like, but I'm happy with that. Take advantage of the fact the physical transformation you can do on the system here can be undone by a physical transformation over there. So should I care about this physical transformation? Not sure yet. Should I care about this physical transformation light years away? Hell no, because it's causally desperately remote for me. I mean, no performable decision theory is going to be something that's going to be able to take into account what might be done light years away. So do I care about that? No. Do I care about whether you leave the state alone or don't leave, whether you leave the state alone or leave it alone? Of course I don't. So given that performing this transformation and this transformation jointly leave the state alone, which I don't care about, and given that performing this transformation on its own is something I don't care about, I'm compelled not to care about this transformation. So that's Wojciech's route for essentially delabelizing the states. And my route for delabelizing them is kind of more direct, just to remove that information in a slightly more simple-minded way, just throw the measuring device into a volcano or something. There's a certain amount of care that needs to be done with that if you want to make the transformations performable, because if you're not careful, you start doing things that require rather fine-tuned coherence of branches. But The short story would go that way. The longer story would say something like that. There's a large collection of erasure states I don't care about. I'm not bothered about the micro details of how the device is in the volcano. So if I've got a process which is guaranteed to be an erasure, I don't mind which erasure process it is. So I think that's basically what's going on in the sort of the equal amplitude case. So I think there that's actually doing something quite profoundly different. And what I take that to be doing is trying to complete a frequentist run of the, basically model the frequentist strategy rather than model the symmetry-based strategy. And I think it turns out that the problems with the symmetry-based strategy don't map over to quantum mechanics, and the problem with the frequency-based strategy basically do map over to quantum mechanics. So what what Everett produced is basically a pretty much literally a quantization of the existing sort of various laws of large numbers. And so it's got the same strengths and weaknesses that you attribute to the frequency approach. What I think is important here is that I don't think it's the case that the sort of thing that Wojciech runs or the sort of thing that Deutsch runs or that I run are in parallel to that the same problems as the classical symmetry approaches, and the reason for that is simply the numerical presence of atoms, the fact the state itself, and not really the laws, has the symmetry approach. Does that help?
Yes,
yeah,
so
it's
exciting paradox.
Yeah, I have two questions. One is sort of a question about reality, and the other a technical question about what would you like first?
Let's have a technical question first.
Well, the technical question is, a given set of alternative histories may exhibit no symmetries whatsoever. That's especially in the case of the histories, for example, are branch dependent. A set of projections that extend a given branch are dependent on the previous whole history of the branch. So is the idea that we should dope out what Born's rule is in these simple models and then simply extrapolate to these more asymmetric cases?
No,
or is there a derivation?
Not exactly. It's more that we're going to do the derivation in a local place. I mean, there's this vast branch of structure which is grossly asymmetric. Just there, that's me. And my little nice local bit there has got that particular symmetry and that nice little local protocol that I've done. And the rest of this stuff is causing an isolated property, so I don't care about it. So it's all going to be at that fairly local level. How will it extrapolate from that to something like, I don't know, probability measures in cosmology? That I'm not quite so sure about. I think we'll do something. We'll be doing a bit of extrapolation in that situation.
Okay, now the fluffy question.
Yeah.
If we look at pilot wave theory, then I think we would take the set of histories to be governed by the trajectories, and we would say that they're all equally real, but only one happened. Is the difference between that and Everett just because in some sense you see the trajectories coming out of the wave function, whereas the other in the pilot wave theory not coming out of the wave function?
Yeah, basically that's right. I mean we kind of got the probability topic, but that's fine. I think the way if there was some precise algorithmic way of deriving the history structure from the quantum state, I mean it's something like Mean have turned out to be a necessary and sufficient condition for quasi-classicality, then I think you have quite a strong argument to say let's replace quantum mechanics with this new stochastic theory that will basically be realizing just one of these. Because of the emergent fuzzy nature of this, because the kind of criteria we're using for picking out branches are rather high level, they're all about high level emergent structure, then it's not the kind of thing we normally would put into our ontology. Our basic physics shouldn't really be containing things to make irreducible reference to very high-level constants. That's basically.
So to paraphrase, just Simon's, if it's higher-level ontology, then everything has to be real. If it's lower-level ontology, then it's okay for one thing to be.
Yeah, basically, if you've got some way of reformulating the theory's equations, so you could just chuck out all the door of it. Then why not do it? But the reason for that, the only other detail about it, of course, is as a minor point, if you did chuck out all one branch, then you would be back to this classical problem about probability. But probably here relies on the symmetry. These are just the non-symmetry state. I'm not quite so gung-ho about the greatest pieces of arguments that I chuck out a perfectly viable single universe theory because they're saying they gave George mine.
About halfway through, you had a bipartite slide that compared the problems with the classical symmetry. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
At some point in some slide like this one, you said something that the classical case can't have the full symmetry. Mm-hmm. Because if the initial state is symmetric, the dynamics are symmetric, then the final state is symmetric, and then there's no definite outcome.
Yeah.
And then in the quantum case, there's an improvement on that because we've got no definite outcome, but that's fine.
Or maybe that thing said multiple definite outcomes.
Yeah. Right. So here's my question: why don't I just go back and reformulate the classical version slightly? I've got a classical many worlds in which I say yes, the initial state is symmetric, the dynamics are symmetric, and the final state is also symmetric over the possible outcomes, and I'm perfectly happy with that, just as I am in the quantum case. Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any deep problem with that. I think the classical many worlds theory is one way that each all there's this measure over the space of different trajectories in base space or something, and they're all physically real. I think that's fine. I think one might feel it's a rather heavy price to pay to solve the probability problem. It's been a very thin ground for us to believe in this vastly enlarged space of physical things. Whereas in the quantum case, you've got lots of independent reasons to take savings to the other branches.
So it's an equally high price in each case, but in the quantum case, I have more reasons to pay that price?
Basically, yeah. I mean, by parallel, I mean, if you think about, there are arguments, it's quite in vogue in cosmology these days to evoke ideas of multiple universes to explain things like inflation issues and various things of that sort. And that's not the same stupid, but it's quite fragile. It's inferring an awful lot of stuff from quite thin argument. And I think this is the situation there is an awful lot more solid. We're not just abstractly making up these things. We're telling an awful lot about the structure of dynamics and how they emerge from what's underlying. It's that kind of situation which, you know, we can't guarantee we'll find it physics, but generally we tend to get lucky to find where things tend to point in the same direction.
David, at one stage you seem to be saying, and I may have misunderstood you, that if the number of outcomes in quantum mechanical experiments was definite, we would have grounds for assigning to all branches. Now that surprised me, because where in, say, the Deutsch-Wallace representation theorem, or in the evidence-based Bayesian updating inductive approach to the Born law, is there the assumption that the number of outcomes is
indefinite? That's good. If I said that, I shouldn't have done. What I intended to say is that the number of branches was the converse. The number of branches is not definite, then we can't find the rule. Actually, even if the number of branches is definite, I think we can't find the rule either, because of similar kind of intertemporal inconsistency issues. Suppose I grant the world into three equal branches, where those branches have three branches with like, more probability one third, but then I'm told that the way the branching process actually happened, albeit it happened in millions of seconds, was actually like that. So then I guess I need half here. So I'd have half, quarter, quarter, according to one way of finding the rule, and a third one the other way of finding the rule. So that sort of thing is quite problematic as well. The only problem with that situation is you might possibly start being more inclined to say the method of doing this starts naturally. I think that's kind of weird, because it's still the case that after a very short physical process, there's the inversion of it. But you might be inclined to think that. So it's kind of, I think it's more robustly clear that you can't let people a branch cap rule, even the branch cap doesn't exist. But you realize branch cap did exist, we still.
Yeah, my question is very much a follow on to Harvey's. What you've shown here is that if one managed to isolate from the background of decoherence enough so that the branch count might be something was real briefly, that probabilities would have very weird properties. The probabilities of the initial branch would change after the second branch had occurred. And the question is, yes, we know that that's not how the probabilities we experience behave, but do we know that that's not the probabilities that would be implied by a bare quantum mechanical theory? In other words, might that not be telling us that there's something wrong with the theory?
Okay, so two responses to this. One is the hypothesis is definitely wildly wrong with the thing. But I'm pretty confident the branch is not my problem. And it's not in place. But for the sake of argument, suppose the world was my problem. I mean, you could have used, so I said in this situation, you've got a dilemma, you benefit the one third, one third, one third, or the one half, one quarter, and you're saying, well, maybe the problems just change. Maybe probability isn't conserved. Maybe even though this situation's got probability one half, this situation's got probability two thirds. If that happened like maybe twice a millennium, we might just find those weird times we had just tested them. If the branching happened millions of times a second, then the connection between this abstract number you're attaching to the branches and anything you might want to call probability is going to break big time. But I was saying before, what do we know about probability? Very little, but we know that it works as a guide to action.
I agree about the probabilities we observe, but they do not change from one half to two thirds. That's the question is whether the underlying dynamics which we have would imply probabilities that did that, and therefore the fact that they don't might say the underlying dynamics is wrong.
Okay, so what it means, you're going to ask yourself, what would it mean for something to imply certain probabilities? You might not say something like this. Here's one reason for what you're saying. You might not say, notwithstanding what you just said, both the one third, one third, one third, and the one half, one quarter, one quarter are incoherent, are unavoidable. Therefore, there is no
rational probability norm in this situation. Therefore, this physical state of affairs, while all this actually say is impossible because it's not a requirement for the universe that allows it to be rational, but it's kind of an assumption we have to make, like the assumption that the past carries on the end of the future in some sense, or that there's not some weird evil demon perceiving us. So we have to assume we don't live in the universe like that. I think that's right. I think the idea of a universe with branch characters nothing playing a role in the quantum weight is not a coherent state of affairs for the magic being. Fortunately, we know that for the ever branch structures of the moment like that, so it's an interesting curiosity.
David Albert.
We started a rather brief summary of what
you're... Oh, that's okay. I mean, and actually, it's a good segue. I'm going to be talking some in my talk about this fatness measure, and I'll say something about why I think that your worries about it aren't altogether compelling. Okay. But I have a slightly different question now, although related to these alternatives.
Yeah.
That there's just something about the logic of the argument I'm not sure I understand. You gave... this symmetry argument, why the probabilities need to be, you know, that's going to lead to the conclusion that the probabilities need to depend on the amplitudes via the wormhole. And then you said, look, people don't usually object to this. They object indirectly by way of proposing alternatives. But I mean, the funny thing was, the thing that I don't get was, if this really is a good argument for this, the expectation would be that what's wrong with all the alternatives could be diagnosable from this.
Yeah.
But that's not the way you diagnosed it.
Okay, let me do, why don't I actually do that diagnosis? It might be
easier.
So the contextuality, the branch way of contextuality proposals I didn't diagnose this way, they don't get to square one because they're not formulated. The two things that do get to square one is use a different quantum state and use something else.
Right.
What's wrong with use something else is that you have some transformation which can erase these two, which would be different.
Well, but that's just what's being denied by something like the phantom.
Well, I think it's not. What you showed was wrong
with the case of the phantom measure depended on considerations of practicability It doesn't seem like it's being diagnosed from here.
If
you disagree with what I just said, if you agree with it, the worry is, gee, but so how many, who knows how many other people
are? I take the point, and I don't agree, I do think it's diagnosed.
Okay.
I think that formally speaking, I use this label plus, so let me for the sake of argument say a plus state is indicated by using force space.
Right.
And a minus state is being indicated by not being force space.
Right.
So that can be the case. And then the erasure process involves you being done, you go on a crash diet, or in other case being fed, so your weight's been normalized.
No, but I don't want to take too much more time, but I'm still puzzled. The argument here didn't have anything to do with practicability. It just had to do with the claim that we wouldn't care.
Okay, then kind of...
A different consideration of practicability is being employed in your worries about the fact.
I think it's your concern that the different sort of practicability is my ability to follow that strategy.
Yes.
Okay. Right, now I understand. Here's the way of putting it in this framework. I think the way of putting it is, what premises in this framework is essentially that I need a single stable strategy, which tells me the same thing no matter where in the chain of steps I evaluate. That is implicit in the framework here, because it assumes, for instance, that if I prepare a system this way, via preparing that way, I'm indifferent between that and going the left.
I thought that had to do with what we would care about, not with what we could accomplish.
Let's talk about it.
Another question about the logic of the sort of whole programming setup.
Yeah.
So, maybe it's possible, but suppose somebody produces an alternative, rational, well-defined strategy. It may not be rational according to axioms, but it looks rational according to beasts. How big a problem, if at all, is that available program?
So I'm claiming that compelling principles of rationality entail So this is the only strategy. So if you produce me another strategy which I agree with rationally, then clearly I'm wrong.
You're clearly wrong, but can't you just retreat and say, well, I could postulate the...
Exactly. So the form, this is, I mean, this is perhaps something I should have made slightly more clear, but this is probably my last slide. The fallback position is that the Everett interpretation does just as well as anything it had previously had kind of probability, that the problem probability has been just as basically stipulated in previous theory, in classical probability theories like Stat-Mech or stochastic theories like GRW. So Everett, it's not a problem for Everett not to do. It would be a kind of interesting fun bonus if it could in fact do it best than that. One of the reasons I talk this way is because in a sense, you could argue that the Everettian, I use this kind of language, that the Everettian code can permit a quote for cheap mistake of bringing the idea up, because that sort of implies that if there are problems with sort of George type bridge or the Jura type bridge, then the Everett interpretation has failed to solve the problem of probability. I think the right thing to say, and this is some science, is that there was never any obligation the Everett interpretation to solve the problem of probability. It had to respond to objections that somehow works. If having bombed those, it couldn't just have better than that. That would be the feedback.
You're
going
to have
to ask
that.
I think
I'll okay. All right, then it's time for coffee. Coffee break.